Testing. Blah, 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 blah. Ready, set, go.
It's time for the Coach Amy and Coach Liz Show,
a podcast for endurance athletes by two athletes, two coaches, and a physical therapist.
We are your hosts, Coach Amy
and Coach Liz,
coming to you from
Kansas City. Hello.
Hi, friends. So you guys can't see this big, bulky boot on Liz's foot, but what's going on? Oh, why do we have a boot on? Well, I mean, not a boot, like a fashion wear boot.
Anyone who knows me is not going to think I have a fashion wear boot on. Don't worry.
But what is 80 degrees out? You don't have your wool boots on? Okay, so what's going on?
Well, I tripped over my own feet, and I broke the base of my fifth metatarsal. It's just a fracture, actually.
Yes, it's a fracture of the bone. And really, you're lucky in some respects, you're unlucky in that the sandal caused you to wrench your foot and break it. But had you done that same level of turn in or inversion of the foot that way, you would have also sprained your ankle and pulled and yanked on the peroneal tendon and peroneal muscles and had a bunch of other soft tissue injuries. But the way that sandal was, it caused the fracture in the first place.
Yeah.
Because it stopped your ankle from actually, you know, rolling over. But anyway, so it's kind of like, imagine just taking someone's foot and wrenching it in the middle. Yeah. And that's what happened to Liz's foot. So what are we going to do about it?
Well, I do feel super lucky because they told me if it had been down any farther that it would have been completely non-weight bearing for 6 weeks. It would have been a whole different ball of wax. And it was actually broken for 2 weeks before I went in. And so I had been walking on it. I'd been riding my bike. I mean, my bike didn't make it worse. So I feel quite lucky that it's not.
And you didn't run on it because
I did not run because it hurt.
So
it
did hurt. You listened to your body there.
I did. Yes. I mean, it was uncomfortable, but it was like, you know, I could soft pedal on my bike. But I knew the second that it turned, I was like, the first thing that came to my head was like, it's going to be at least 6 weeks before I can walk on this or run on it or do something. So I just like immediately disavowed any notion that I'd be able to do that. I don't know what we were talking about.
Well, what prompted you to go to urgent care then? Like, what part of it made you think, okay, this is worse than just
it swelled, of course, at first. And then it was 2 weeks when I decided to go in, and it just had, like, there was a little place on my foot that was still, it was kind of like, you know, when you hurt something and it's like, you can't, sometimes it's hard to tell where that acute part is because the whole thing sort of swells and hurts, right? Mm-hmm. And so over the 2 weeks, a lot of the swelling and the discomfort had, you know, healed or gone away, but there was still this one spot that just wasn't right, and it had a little like swollen lump over it. And I was like, I couldn't roll through my gate at all. And I was like, I just wanted to get it taken care of because I want it to heal, which it doesn't sound like it because you waited 2 weeks to go in, but I didn't think it was broken. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've broken a couple small things, but I just really didn't know. It can be hard to tell the difference between soft tissue and bone.
Yes, initially. Kind of the, you know, that centralization of the pain, then that pinpoint tenderness, the, you know, rolling through the foot, not being able to weight bear or walk normally is another sign where it's like, okay, now I'm going to start compensating somewhere else. I better make sure, you know, what am I going to do to treat this now besides just rest from running, right?
Well, and you know, I feel lucky. I mean, the good thing about being in our position and like as a coach is that you see athletes go through this so much, and you see what happens when you wait or when you like don't, you know, back off the way you should. And I was like, and it's your feet, you know, and your feet, again, I've just seen what happens when people's feet don't work right, and it goes all the way up. It's going to go to the knees, it's the hips, it's the shoulders, it's going to go all the way up. And I was like, well, I can deal with this now, or I can deal with it for the next 10 years.
Right. Good point. So can we tell them what we're doing to treat it in the meantime?
Do it. Yes.
Okay. So I got a text from Liz, you guys, like, so while we're in this period of time where we have to immobilize it, right, to protect it, So we're going to do, we're doing, so we did yesterday, we did some laser on the foot. So high intensity class 4 laser, not red light therapy from
Amazon. Not space lasers.
Right. Not space lasers that burn holes in metal. Although they do heat up tattoos.
Oh my gosh. This laser, we'll get to that. Holy hell.
But yeah, so laser has a lot of value. It does a lot of things. But in this case, we are going to promote the bone healing and so and help with that. So, and, you know, in some other ways too, it'll help us decrease inflammation. But that's not our main reason for choosing that modality. So we're gonna start with that, and then you're gonna hook up with the foot and ankle specialist here in town, Dr. McCullough, and he'll take a look at it and give you any other recommendations that he has for you.
But I'm gonna tell people what the laser was like, because I'm in this boot, and it's supposed to be on all the time unless I'm taking a shower. But we take the boot off, yes, and you pull out this little device. It looks like the Edison light bulb. It's like this guy. It's very cute. It's just this little thing, and it's hooked up to your big fancy laser machine, and you just run it over that area for 10 minutes. And so you just put all over that area.
The amount of time depends on the issue or the surface area, and also the intensity of it. So we did, you know, 25 watts, continuous watts application. And then in the end, so we'll end up with a certain amount of energy that was, you know, that was applied. But, and we had to put on our goggles.
Special goggles.
So we didn't burn our retinas.
Yeah.
So we have to have safety. And then Liz has this tattoo on her foot. It's a ladybug. And it, fortunately, it is not in the area of the fracture. But it's close to it. So when I removed the laser, but it was still shining on your foot, even from a distance while I was chatting with you, what happened?
I mean, it was like my foot was on fire.
It was hot.
And it was 2 seconds. Like, all you did was direct it, and it felt like, I mean, it felt like I was touching a hot stove, and it was just over the tattoo.
Yeah. So, and the reason for that is that the ladybug has some black ink on it, and so that very, very dark ink heats up really fast. So what's an interesting thing to note when you're using the laser is that different skin color types. Mm-hmm. So the darker the skin, we have to make an adjustment to the intensity.
That's so interesting. Which makes sense because, I mean, you think about, like, even in, like, if you're out running in the sun and you're wearing, like, something light versus something dark, and how the light gets absorbed into different colors differently.
Yeah. And when I'm working on somebody and maybe I have their limb propped up on me, you know, and I've got black pants on, mm-hmm, even though the laser is not on my black pants, it's in proximity, and it I can feel the heat.
That is bananas. Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, it hurt like a mother.
We didn't. We stayed shy of that ladybug for sure after that.
I was like, you're going to kill me. Anyway, I'm thankful for the treatment.
Yes.
And I'm thankful. I mean, you know, this could have happened when I was in big training, or it could be something required surgery. Like,
in your life where you have, you know, plenty of time to let it recover, and no worries. And so we will keep you guys updated on
the fascinating foot.
Yeah, and like all the stuff that we're going to do to help with it. It's pretty straightforward with a fracture. So it's almost, and I hate to say this, but you know, not a full-blown fracture with, like, where we have to have pins put in and surgery. No. It's kind of like sometimes a soft tissue injury can be way...
Oh, I think it'd be way worse.
Way worse.
I always say I'd rather break a bone.
Yeah, which we don't want to say that. And I think you have said that.
I have. I say it all the time. Because I feel like I watch people out there. When you have something with a soft tissue and how hard it is to even get a diagnosis, like what you have to go through.
And then the treatments are...
And then the treatment's longer. And there's no, like... You can't do another thing where it's like, okay, you've done the treatment and it's good. Like with a bone, you can tell it's healed. And then I know there's other stuff you have to rehab for sure around it. But I 100% would rather have a fracture than a
soft tissue injury. And it's easier to do too much with a soft tissue injury.
Yes.
And to find that right recipe where fractures are fractures.
Yeah.
Like, here, we're not going to weight bear on this for 6 weeks, blah, blah, blah. Here we go.
And mentally, it's like, you know, you have this block of time and you're going to have to rehab it. But
yeah,
those soft tissue stuff, I watch what people go through trying to figure out what's causing the pain. And especially if you don't have an acute accident, like it's just a soft tissue problem.
It's a chronic injury that developed over time, and it's and you got to figure out all the puzzle pieces as to why this happened. It's crazy. I love it. It's my job.
It
is. I mean, I don't love that people get it, but I love solving the problem, puzzle pieces.
And it's because, you know, you're really good at figuring that stuff out because it's, you know, I watch people bunny hop around trying to chase down. I mean, it can I have athletes that it's taken
years. Yeah, it could take years. So one thing to note, and this is me talking to you, but everybody gets to listen to it.
Oh, God,
is that it is like, 6 weeks in the boot, but that doesn't mean we get to take it off and then run. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But sometimes people think, oh, well, it's the bone and it's healed and it's good to go.
No.
But there is a durability factor here on the bone. So just like with muscles and tendons, we're going to have to gradually add, you know, stress to it on purpose, but carefully. So, so just so you know.
No, I know. You know, when I was living in Hawaii, and this was before I even did triathlon, I was using my bike to go to work, and I was at a stoplight, and this dear senior man who should not have been driving ran the stoplight, and he hit me, and my bike went on top of his car, and then he ran into a light pole, and I flew off, and I broke my wrist. And I ran my first marathon with a broken wrist. But my point with that is that when I got the cast off, it was probably, I don't think it was a year, but it was a really long time before I could push myself out of the pool again, like with that pressure on it, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's that you just had to, it took a long time for it to work itself back up.
Yeah. And, you know, that was like, that's not a normal, well, it's weight-bearing joint for ADLs, for activities of daily living, like pushing yourself up. And then, of course, we know that that foot with running is going to be 6 times or more of your body weight jumping up and down on it. So we'll have to gradually get there, but we will.
I see her stern look.
And that was just my, like,
warning, I will willingly
warning
follow.
Eyeballs
I do not
telling
want
you how it
to,
is, not sugarcoating
I
it.
Don't want to have any lingering effects. Okay.
Anyway. Okay. So anyway, our topic for today is swimming. It's something about swimming.
It is about swimming. So we are going to talk about using a time clock in swimming and rest intervals versus what I call clock intervals. So we're going to just going to back up. And when people initially start to swim, getting to the point where you're using a clock and swimming, for some people, it can come quickly. I feel like for most people, it's a very slow progression, and it may be like, you know, 3 months to a year before you're really starting to use a clock. Because initially you have to be able to connect the brain with the movements. And, you know, we talk about, like, if you read anything about like habits in life, the reason for habits is because it takes the need for decisions out of what you're doing. So if you had to make a decision about every single thing you did in life, your brain, like, decision fatigue is real. It affects your brain. We have habits to allow our brain to do things automatically and free up space for us to make decisions about things that are important.
And practice makes that happen.
And so when you first start to swim, your brain is so consumed, number one, with breathing, mm-hmm. right? Like it doesn't want to die. And then trying to make those movements happen. And so, you know, I just like that example because I feel like it really puts on display the need for habits in our daily life, because as you get better at swimming and those things become more automated, then you are able to think about more things that, you know, expand what you can focus on while you're swimming. And eventually you get to the point where like your stroke is functional and you want to start to put some strength behind that. And so your next step is then learning how to do that and to vary your pace and like, what does it feel like to go easy versus hard? And then kind of, you know, developing that, which is something that actually should happen a little bit more slowly than people think it does. Because when we start to speed up in swimming, people often just really start to compromise their form. So that is another podcast unto itself, is like, how do you start to learn how to swim hard in swimming, which is a missed conversation in a lot of things. You know, you see a lot about how to reduce drag in swimming, and you see a lot about how to increase propulsion, and both of those things will help you go faster in swimming. But there is very little information about how to make the jump from focusing on like technique and reducing drag to how you actually increase propulsion and how to do that effectively without just spinning your arms. And like, mm-hmm. you can certainly increase how hard you're working without increasing how fast you're going. Mm-hmm. That is a different podcast. But when I like to mention that when we're talking about starting to use a clock, because people will start trying to go hard in swimming. And once you start introducing like the concept of using time, you know, that it's very different than biking and running, where you can just try harder and you'll go faster. So as we talk about clock intervals, keep in mind that there is a progression to actually starting to put more strength behind a stroke you've developed. And you don't want to lose all that work you've done to develop your stroke. And so, you know, working hard takes some nuance in swimming. But once you're to the point where you can start using a clock, the first thing you're going to do is start timing your rest. So you can time rest and you can time work, and you can manipulate the rest and the work during any training session to make it easier or harder, right? So more rest, easier, less rest, harder. The harder you work, you know, it's fairly self-explanatory. But for swimming, because of how much you're having to think about when you're starting to learn how to work hard in the water, you actually start out timing your rest, not your work. So you may swim a length of the pool and say, I'm going to time my rest and I'm going to take 10 or 15 seconds rest at the end of that length, and then I'm going to repeat the length. And so what you're doing there is just learning how to take consistent amounts of rest and see what that feels like for you. So is 10 seconds rest feel hard, or can you recover your breath in 10 seconds? And just start to learn what that feels like, especially because swimming is a sport where you're holding your breath. And so the hard work is compounded by not necessarily having enough oxygen. So it really is a different learning curve than if you were to say, I'm going to go do repeats on the track and rest for 10 seconds. Well, you get to breathe as much as you want. You're going to have a little bit more information going into that than you will with swimming. But that's a really important first step, is that you're at the point now where you are comfortable enough with your swim stroke that you're able to swim a length of the pool and then actually have the wherewithal to look at a clock and count to 10. When you are starting to swim, that's not usually the case, right? So you've progressed to that point. The next thing, say you get comfortable with that and you know that you can rest for 10 seconds or 5 seconds after each length of the pool, and you've built that up and you feel like you're ready for another challenge, the next thing you're gonna do is start timing your actual work. So how long does it take you to swim the length of that pool? And then you rest 10 seconds. And so now you're timing both the work and the clock and the rest. And what you're looking for there is like, can I swim like 8 lengths of the pool on 10 seconds rest and hold my time, right? Like, will it take me 30 seconds to swim the length of the pool? I rest 10 seconds and I can repeat that for 8 times without really falling apart, right? Yeah. Looking for that progression. So say you've done that, and then you progress to 2 lengths of the pool, hundreds. And so now you've gotten to the point where you're comfortable timing both your work intervals and your rest. And that's where most people stop with swimming. That's where most people, they're like, I'm going to do 8 50s on 10 seconds rest. Okay, great. And that's how they do all of their workouts. Now, and that's fine, but especially when people get like sort of stuck in swimming and they don't seem to be able to progress. Like they're, you know, a lot of triathletes get stuck at like that, roughly that 2 minute per 100 barrier of time. So 100 is 4 lengths of the pool and it takes them about 2 minutes. Maybe they're 155, maybe they're 205, but that's a pretty standard place that triathletes get stuck and they don't seem to be able to progress. And it's because they're not challenging themselves anymore in the water. So that's where you can take the next step. And instead of using what you call rest intervals, where it's like I'm resting for 10 seconds at the end of each length, we move to what I call clock intervals. And clock intervals are what like swimmers use. And the idea behind that is, I'm just going to go ahead and give the example. So if I were to, there's two ways to give a set. If I'm going to say, okay, I want you to swim 8 50s, which is 8 times 2 lengths of the pool, 8 50s on 10 seconds rest. That's one way to put it. And you go and you swim each 50, and say your first 50, you swim it in a minute. And by that 8th 50, you're swimming it in a minute and 10 seconds. Okay. So they've gotten slower as you've progressed through that set. But you still get 10 seconds rest after each one of those swims. With the clock interval, what you're doing is, instead of specifying the amount of rest, it would be something like, you're going to do 8 times 50 on 1 minute and 15 seconds. And so that means you have 1 minute and 15 seconds to go down and back, and then whatever is remaining is the amount of rest that you get, right? Yeah. And so if it takes you 1 minute to swim down and back, you get 15 seconds rest. But as your set gets, as you get slower, and say maybe by the 6th one, it's taking you 1 minute and 5 seconds to go down and back, you now only get 10 seconds rest. Mm-hmm. So now it's changing the amount of rest that you're getting, and especially as you get more tired, the farther you get into a set, it really increases the intensity of the work you're doing. And so that is like, it's a really important differentiation between just taking a rest interval and learning to actually use that clock. And then, you know, and that also, you have to be at a point where you can pay attention close enough to your swimming that you're like, well, it took me, you know, 1 minute and 5 seconds to swim down and back, and now I get 10 seconds rest. And then the next 50, it takes you 1 minute and 7 seconds. And so you only get, you know, whatever that would be, 8 seconds of rest. So there's some math that starts to happen. And with watches these days, in my day, we used the clock on the wall. Yeah. We didn't get to do any of that. But now with watches, well, it used to be, you know, we had the, if you've seen the big clocks on the pool deck, I'm not even talking digital clocks. It's just like the clock with the red hand that goes around. Oh, I mean, yeah. That's like, you know, so you're doing... There was a lot of math involved and you really had to pay attention and you wanted all your rest. So if it was like you came in at 1:11 and you left at 1:15, like you had to be able to come up from whatever set you were doing while you're gasping for air, look and see it's 11, you know. So there was a lot. Yeah. Now with watches, you can program that. So it makes it a little bit easier to do. Makes it a lot easier to do, but you do have to really pay attention. And it just, it very much changes how you are training and how you're stressing the body.
So what I'm hearing from you is that like that's this last kind of this clock intervals is for so kind of an advanced swimmer, and it's what swimmers who are training to swim are using, and triathletes can also get to that point to kind of push them over to the next level with their swim.
I mean, if triathletes want to get better at swimming, they should be using clock intervals, and there's no reason you can't. And it doesn't matter like where you are in your swim. And, you know, if you're somebody who's like really just wants to get through the swim and, you know, or maybe you're somebody who like you're not ready for clock intervals, like you don't have to do them. But if you're somebody that has an interest in actually making your swim better.
And someone who is interested in the swim better and has noticed that you plateaued
and you've
out
that you plateaued.
In your training.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when you gave me the rest interval stuff.
Yeah.
Boy, with the 10 seconds is... nothing.
It's not.
In the swim.
It's not.
It's so short.
But once, you know, you can see your fitness progress when you get to a point where 10 seconds is enough.
Yes. But here's what I would do is I would, you know, I would slow down.
Well, and see, that's where the clock intervals don't let you do that.
Right. So I can see where that would come in handy at some point.
At some point.
It was still good training because I still... I never got to the point where I was actually timing how quickly I was going down the pool, but I was striving to get, whether you told me, okay, easy, moderate, or strong, I would try to go for that. So even if it ended up being a little bit slower, I was still, my rate of perceived exertion was still hitting what 100%. You wanted me to hit. So the training was wonderful. I mean, I had to start, you guys, my feet were dragging on the floor when I was first started working with Liz, and both you and David were like, you're fighting the water. And I was like, oh, that's a really good description of how I feel. But once I found my balance in the water and I was able to do the swim training, it was huge for me. And really about, you know, finishing and not treading water.
Well,
100%. I mean, it was, you know.
And I say people should be using the clock, I don't want to, I mean, there's a very long progression to get to that point. I mean, for some people, it can be a matter of years before you're ready to really do that. So there's a huge amount of work that's not only beneficial, but essential. And you get plenty out of that. Like I'm talking about somebody that's maybe, you know, they've been doing it for, you know, 5 years and they can't figure out why their swimming's getting better. And they, you know, it just, there's a time.
And I want to say something here too, because, you know, what I found is once I found my balance in the water and I was no longer fighting the water, all my cardio, endurance, and fitness from running allowed me to probably advance into those kind of rest interval type training a lot quicker than if I didn't already have that. Because I was able to tap into that because I had a more efficient stroke.
And that's the thing that triathletes... it's confusing for triathletes or people who come to swimming with some level of fitness, is that their cardiovascular fitness is like so much is ready for more. And I will say that there is a learning pattern with swimming and that cardiovascular fitness, because we don't do anything else in life where we hold our breath. So that's a very real part of developing your swim. But it is also, you have cardiovascular fitness. So once you've learned that breathing pattern, it is, you know, people who have some level of fitness want to get in there and go really hard in that swim, but neuromuscularly and possibly even from a, like a muscular strength perspective, they just can't do it. And if you rush that progression, you end up with a really inefficient stroke that makes your heart rate go up and is super inefficient and is probably never going to get the most out of your stroke. Yeah. And so it's, you know, it's a sort of a nuanced progression. And so, you know, you don't want to just go in and start using clock intervals, but it's a really worthwhile tool that I think kind of gets missed sometimes.
Yeah. And word to note, I noticed that when I started to learn practicing swimming with the appropriate breath work and everything and kind of figuring that out, that breathing actually helps with running.
Oh, hell yeah, it does.
And it's
oh, hell yeah.
It's amazing. So even if you aren't a triathlete,
oh, yeah,
and you enjoy swimming or want to learn how to swim.
Because we know everybody enjoys swimming. I can see you all like, don't turn this podcast off. I can see you rolling your eyes out there. But I will
anyway,
tell you what.
Swimming can be a great cross training for running from the perspective of the breath work, but also for, we've talked about this in past episodes on recovery, for assistance with recovery, unloading the joints in a way. So, you know, swimming can have great benefits even if you aren't a triathlete.
It's true.
Okay, so let's recap on this swimming episode.
I mean, basically it just take your time with learning to swim, but make sure you keep, you know, figuring out how to stress the body in new ways that are productive.
Yeah.
And at some point,
and if you've
using
reached this
clock,
sort of plateau and you're not getting better, consider the clock intervals.
Yeah. Thanks so much for listening. And remember,
we are in this together. Until next time.